Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb. On today's episode, I'll be chatting with Adam Frank, a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester and author of the new book, The Little Book of Aliens, which is available now in all formats. So hey, let's jump right into the conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy this one. Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
You discussed this a bit in the new book, The Little Book of Aliens. And of course, I have to ask you about it here in the episode. How did you first become interested in the possibility of alien life?
It's hard for me to remember a time when I wasn't interested in the possibility of alien life. As I discuss in the book, I got my start on this when I was 5 years old, when I wandered into my dad's library. My dad was a writer who had an interest in science fiction. And there on the lower levels of the library, you know, the lower shelf, there was all of his pulp science fiction magazines, all those amazing stories and Isaac Asimov's, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And those pictures, you know, every cover had a semi-lurid illustration of dudes bouncing around on, you know, alien worlds in Michelin tire spacesuits, or rocket ships blasting through space, or bug-eyed monsters and aliens. And from that moment on, like, I've never had any other choice. So, you know, after 30 years of being an astronomer, of being an astrophysicist, including, you know, a fair amount of time recently, last decade or so, focusing on astrobiology, I wrote the book because I really wanted people to see how close we were to scientists finding evidence one way or the other for alien life where they live on alien planets.
Now, I'll get back to like the real hunt for extraterrestrial life here in a second. But on the subject of just media that inspired you, were there any particular favorite films? And I have to add the caveat, I'm asking this as someone who appreciates both higher brow sci-fi, but also the silliest cheese. So don't shy away from mentioning anything from the discount bin.
Plan 9 from Outer Space. Oh. No, that actually not. So listen, I'm a huge science fiction fan. Huge. Mm-hmm. And so when I was a kid, I devoured everything there was. And you kids today don't know how bad it was back then. Right? Back then, you literally had Star Trek reruns. So this is the mid-70s, right, when I'm coming mm-hmm. up as a kid. Star Trek reruns. You had Lost in Space, which was terrible, right? And then there was all the bad science fiction movies from the 50s that would rerun on like Saturday morning at 11:30 on what was called Chiller Theater, which was, mm-hmm. On channel 11 back in the days when you only had like five or six channels. So I devoured everything. And so the things, the highbrow stuff I loved were my dad. I remember one night my dad waking me up and say, come on, come on, you got to watch this. And it was Forbidden Planet, right? Wow. Which is this classic, which is amazing because it's this, it's the embodiment of the 1950s pulp science fiction, but it's really smart, right? It's really actually based on The Tempest. And the key idea that it has in there, which I explore in the book quite a bit, I have a whole chapter on it, is the idea of dead, ancient, alien civilizations, right? The vision of the Krell machinery when they're down in the planet, if anybody's ever seen that. So, you know, so all of Star Trek, all of, you know, movies like This Island Earth, you know, which wasn't so great, but then, so all of that really shaped my own thinking about aliens and about space. It really mattered quite a bit to me. There's also a show called UFOs, which do you know of that one? Have you ever seen that
one? I don't think I know that one, no.
It was a British show. It was actually a precursor to Space 1999. Do you know Space 1999?
I know that one, yeah.
Yeah, so this was actually the same kind of models. You'll see a lot of similarities. And it ran, you know, you can find it on the internet if you want. And it was this idea that, you know, the UFOs were coming to steal human organs. And there was a secret shadow organization which was protecting the Earth from that. And I loved that as well. So pretty much anything I could get my hands on, I watched endlessly. And of course, Marvel Comics. Because there was a whole space side of, yeah, you know, Star-Lord. You know, I was the science advisor for Doctor Strange. And I got to meet Kevin Feige. We were, you know, in the room working on the script together. And he asked me, you know, what was your favorite Marvel? And I got to like totally nerd out. And there's this like this little known edition of Star-Lord from the 70s, which was actually my favorite because it was a space opera. It was a space adventure. Mm-hmm. So all of that really shaped my pop culture understanding. And up until streaming, I think I could claim I'd seen every science fiction movie, TV show ever made. Once streaming happened, I was overwhelmed. But
now I'm glad you mentioned like the, you know, aliens coming for organs and so forth, because of course that's a huge part of it, the scarier visions of what alien contact might consist of. And like for my own part, I remember there was a short period in my childhood when I had just seen some UFO episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. Yeah. And I became legitimately scared for a short amount of time that UFO abduction could happen to me.
Right.
I just wasn't exposed to like speculative or that many optimistic views of what UFOs could consist of. So I can't help but wonder how many others were sort of fundamentally primed that way toward the possibility of alien life.
Well, you know, I have there's a chapter in the book where I look at sort of the pop culture effects of aliens, because, you know, one of the amazing things that is happening right now, and which is really kind of the purpose or one purpose of the book, is to show people how the search for life in the universe is now totally scientifically legitimate, which it wasn't when I was coming up. When I was coming up as a graduate student in the 80s, the search for life was either a joke, or it was considered a dead end because the Viking probes in the 70s to Mars hadn't really found anything. So it was a really sort of dead period in the search for life. And then now, you know, for reasons I'm sure we're going to talk about, and the reason they know that, which is what a lot of the book is about, we're really, you know, the next giant telescope is going to be built focusing on the detection of life. So you're right that the pop culture really shaped a lot of people's opinions about what we should think about with aliens and what life in the universe might be. Now, you know, as I discuss in the book, and I'm sure we're going to talk about, I'm very skeptical about that UFOs have anything to do with life outside the universe. But again, as you say, the pop culture stuff, the UFOs and the TV and the movies, whether highbrow or lowbrow, shaped people's understanding of how we should be thinking about life in the universe. And the amazing thing about the science is that the science takes us actually in a more imaginative and more amazing directions, because you've got to really try and think about it in a systematic way. But it's interesting to note, right? Many people are afraid of aliens or feeling like they're it's either one. Either the aliens are like these gods who are coming down to give us the cures for cancer, or they're coming to eat us or mate with us, you know, one or the others.
So you mentioned the 70s being this pivotal point, and you talk about this in the book. What did serious consideration of potential alien life look like prior to the 70s and the advent of SETI, and what were the limiting factors and how did it change?
Yeah. So what's interesting is this question: are we alone? is one of the oldest human questions around. You can see the Greeks arguing about it. And, you know, the book starts with this discussion of the history of this. So Aristotle and Democritus, you can see them kind of arguing with each other in writing from 2,500 years ago. Giordano Bruno gets burnt at the stake, you know, for heresy, which had to do with Catholic doctrine. But really, one of the reasons he got in trouble was he was advocating for this Copernican view that the Earth was just one planet of many, and many of those planets out among the stars would be inhabited. But what happens, actually, the first pivotal decade is the 50s, because you get the Fermi paradox and you get the Drake equation. You get these two things happening at the beginning and the end, which are the first sort of scientific questions that you could ask scientifically. You could pose a research problem and carry it out. And then Frank Drake carries out at the end of that 1960, the first astrobiological experiment ever done. So he takes two radio telescopes and he points them at the sky and he looks for signals from you know, an intelligent civilization, something like might be beaming off of Earth right now. Mm-hmm. And that is the first time anybody's been able to do any kind of experiment asking whether it's dumb life, you know, microbial life, or smart life, meaning that builds civilizations. So that launches SETI. That launches the scientific inquiry about a life in the universe. And through most of the 60s, it's you know, now SETI becomes a field, but it's very marginal. It's still in the, you know, there's a few brave scientists doing it, but it's still kind of seen to be kind of out there. And then what happens is the UFOs and everything that's going on with UFOs, which is, you know, tends to be the conspiracy theories and the hoaxes and that starts to cloud the public's opinion about, and the scientists' even opinion about things like SETI. Now, NASA is also at the same time conducting searches. Is thinking about life on planets in the solar system. So there's the Viking landers to Mars, which scoop up some soil and try and test for sort of Earth-like microbes. Those have inconclusive results, negative or inconclusive results. So by the time you're coming into the 80s, the search for life in the universe is either you still have this sort of what we call the giggle factor, that if you tried to mention the search for life in the universe, particularly the search for intelligent life, meaning industrial technological life. Yeah, eyebrows are going to raise. Congress, literally, some congressmen make hay. And I talk about this, the giggle factor, mm-hmm. in the book, and show people how this happened. Congress, like, doesn't even allow NASA to fund SETI because the congressmen are like, this is a waste of taxpayers' dollars, you know. Mm-hmm. So by the time you're into the late 80s, when I'm a graduate student, SETI is just, there's a few brave pioneers who are living on, you know, private funds. Not that SETI never really got a lot of funding, and that's an important part of this. But it's living on fumes. There really is barely any SETI going on. And people, the thought about, you know, even dumb life on planets had stalled. And so when you're coming into the 1990s, the idea of life in the universe is almost nobody cares. Nobody's paying it except for, you know, some pioneers. And certainly when I was a scientist then, there was this sense of like, oh, don't even think about that. That's a dead end, you know, or you're going to become a joke. Don't waste your career on that, which is amazing. Because again, that's the point of the book, is to show that right now, this is the most important issue in astronomy, or one of the most important issues in astronomy. If you're a young astronomer, good shot that you're going to aim your career at astrobiology. Quite a change, right?
Oh, yes. So you mentioned the Fermi paradox and the Drake equation. What do you think are the most important fundamentals for listeners, or just like the alien curious, alien optimist, or skeptics out there to take home concerning these two properties?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rob, because the point here is that whether you are into UFOs or not into UFOs, if you want to think about life in the universe at all, and that's why, you know, why I lay out this history in the book in this short, fun chapters. You know, it is literally a little book of aliens, because I wanted people to have an easy way in and out for this. You have to deal with the Fermi paradox and the Drake equation. So let's think about the Fermi paradox first. The Fermi paradox just asks the question, if life is common, particularly intelligent life, then why aren't they everywhere, right? And that can take two forms. One is, why aren't they here now, right? What Fermi recognized very quickly, he kind of did the calculation in his head and saw that a spacefaring race, even if it's going it can only go at a tenth of the speed of light, which we believe is the limit for any, and nothing can travel faster than light, that you would cross the galaxy and you could hop from star system to star system in a time that's very short compared to the age of the galaxy. Long for us, it's on the order of 600,000 years. But in terms of the galaxy should be entirely populated. So one way of interpreting that is, why aren't they here now? right? And so there's various answers to that. But there's an indirect version of that, which is more important because people often have this feeling that, oh, every night astronomers like take their telescopes and look at the sky searching for evidence of alien intelligences, right? And nothing could be further from the truth, right? That's a version, what I call that, the indirect Fermi paradox is, well, we've looked and we haven't found. But as I've said, because of the giggle factor, we haven't looked, right? We have not done those searches. There's never been any money funding to use telescopes to do that. So Jason Wright and colleagues did a study where they showed that if the sky was like the ocean, how much of the ocean have we searched? And, you know, and aliens were fish. How much of the ocean have we searched for? And the answer is a hot tub, right? That's how you take all the SETI searches and you combine them. And we've basically looked at a hot tub's worth of ocean. Now, if you looked at a hot tub's worth of water and didn't find any fish, would you then say, oh, there's no fish in the ocean? So the answer is we just haven't looked. But we are looking now. Like, finally, there's funding, right? Finally, there's a community of scientists with the backing of, you know, the government science agencies to really start this search for life. Whether it's again dumb life or smart life, it doesn't matter. We finally know where to look. We finally know how to look, and we're looking. So that's the Fermi paradox. The Drake equation. What's important about it was in 1960, after doing this, his first search, he was asked by the government, of all people, to lead a workshop on interstellar communications. And so they brought together a few people, eight or nine researchers. And what Drake needed to do, he needed an agenda for the meeting. You know, like, what do we even talk about? And what he did is he took the problem. The question is, how many intelligent civilizations are there in the galaxy? And he broke it up into seven sub-problems, which when you multiply their answer together, you get the answer to the big question. And it turned out that those sub-problems became so famous because he offered people a way of breaking this big problem up into smaller problems that you could actually do research on. For example, the first sub-problem is how many stars are there, right? That's the first thing you want to know. And he already knew that, right? The second sub-problem was how many planets are there, or what's the fraction of stars with planets? At the time, nobody knew what that was. It could have been that the universe was barren, you know, that our solar system was a freak, and most stars don't have planets. And now we've answered that question, thanks to the Drake equation. And people said, like, oh, that's the next question we need to answer. We now know that every star in the sky hosts a family of worlds. That happened in the 90s, the beginning in the 90s. And that was the beginning of this change, right? That was a massive revolution in astrobiology because it told us that the place where life forms, which is planets, those are common. Those are as cheap as dirt. And then the next term in the Drake equation was, for every star that has planets, how many planets are in the right place for life to form, which we think has to do with liquid water on the surface. How many are in this Goldilocks band of orbits where it's not too hot, and not too cold, so you can have liquid water on the surface. And the answer for that is 1 in 5. So go outside tonight, look up at the night sky. Every star you see has worlds orbiting it. And every 5 of those has a planet that's sitting there where the experiment with life and civilizations even is being run by the universe.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So getting into what we're looking for, I thought we might ask about technosignatures and biosignatures. In 2019, you became principal investigator on NASA's first grant to study technosignatures. So what are they, and how are we looking for them? And what have we found?
Yes. So the amazing thing about these revolutions, so the exoplanet revolution, as I call it, started in 1995 when we discovered our first planet. Within another 10 or 20 years or so, we had figured out how to look into the atmospheres of those planets. And what happens is, you know, we detect planets as they, when they orbit in front of their star. It's like a little tiny eclipse. The planet passes in front of the star and blocks the light. But if the planet has an atmosphere, there's a little while when the light from the star passes through the atmosphere and reaches us. And when that happens, it leaves an imprint. There's some of the light is absorbed by chemicals, compounds, molecules in the atmosphere. And we can use that. Every one of those imprints is like a fingerprint of what's in that atmosphere. So we call that atmospheric characterization. And so what's in that imprint, it potentially are signatures of things like a biosphere, right? So the Earth has a biosphere. It's the sum total of all the life on the planet, all the plants, all the plankton. It leaves a giant imprint in the light from Earth. And the same thing can happen in an alien world. So a biosignature would be something like oxygen, right? On Earth, the only reason oxygen is in the atmosphere is because life puts it there. If life goes away, the oxygen goes away very quickly. So if you discover oxygen on in an alien world, that's a good shot that that planet has life, a robust biosphere. So oxygen, dimethyl sulfide, that is a chemical which is in Earth's atmosphere. It's only there because all the plankton are kind of farting it out there. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole long list, and then we're generating more and more lists of biosignatures, which if we detect them, that will be evidence that there's life on that planet. Technosignatures, this is a newer field. And as you say, I'm the principal investigator on the first time NASA was willing to fund the search for intelligent life. NASA had been funding the search for dumb life for a while, but because of that giggle factor, technosignatures or, you know, intelligent life was not on the list. Now it is. So the group I'm part of, we are looking for, or we're designing, we're coming up with the list of possible technosignatures. So one, what are they? One, we just wrote a paper on this, chemicals, industrial chemicals. So for example, chlorofluorocarbons or CFCs. These are the things that, you know, we were using in air conditioners that got pumped into the atmosphere and were destroying the ozone hole, right? Those things actually, so either by pollution or if you were trying to terraform Mars, you would purposely pump them into an atmosphere because they're great greenhouse gases actually. So we showed that even with the James Webb Space Telescope, you could detect chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere of a world that was 40 light years away, if it had levels close to our level even now. So and chlorofluorocarbons cannot be, there is just no way nature produces them. They're too complex and weird. Discover those, you've discovered there's a technological civilization there on that planet. If you discover those in a planet's atmosphere, city lights, if a civilization is using artificial illumination, we may be able to detect the spectral signature, the signature in light of those cities. The large scale use of solar panels, you would be able to see the reflectance, all that light bouncing off the solar panels, you'd be able to see. And the list goes on and on. We may be able to detect, if you have a lot of satellites in orbit, in geosynchronous orbit, you might be able to detect, they call that the Clark Belt after Arthur C. Clarke. You might be able to detect that. So, you know, the list goes on. And these, we're figuring out now exactly how to look for those. So once people start doing these observations, they'll be able to they'll be able to know exactly where to look. So it's amazing. We actually have the technology now so that over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, we're going to have actual data relevant to the question. Whereas the last 2,500 years have been people yelling at each other or burning each other at the stake.
I think it's fascinating that with the technosignatures, you're talking about things that have a lot more nuance to them, I guess, arguably, compared to what might pop into a lot of sci-fi viewers' heads, that being something like a Dyson sphere or a Dyson cloud, something they've seen on Star Trek and so forth.
Right. Yeah, you know, the Dyson sphere is still ongoing, though. There's still people looking for, alien megastructures. Who doesn't love saying alien megastructure? That's still an ongoing concern. And, you know, with one of the important pieces of the history that I talk about in the book is Bajoyan star, or Tabby star, people call it different. This was a star we were looking at with, you know, the Kepler Space Telescope, which is a planet finder. And rather than the sort of smooth eclipse that we expect when a planet passes in front of the star, what they were seeing signals of, like, they couldn't understand it. It was like the light from the star was blotting out and then coming back and then blotting out again, blotting, nothing. So when people were thinking about this, they made their list of possible, what this was, comets, clouds of dust, broken up planets. And at the bottom of the list was alien megastructures. And that was 2014, 2017. That blew the doors off of the fact that they even mentioned this in the paper and that everyone was like, oh, yeah, okay, could be, kind of signaled that, you know, if you're doing this work, you can't laugh, you can't giggle about that possibility anymore. If you're going to stare at hundreds, thousands of planets and, you know, look for biosignatures, you can't ignore the possibility of that some of these are going to have technosignatures. So an apocryphal moment in this study where people were finally, you know, the giggle factor had was gone. And it's like, yeah, sure. Okay. That's one of the things we have to consider. It's probably last on the list because, you know, you want to consider things you already know exist, but it's there. And you know, at some point we may have a planet where you really are going to take that seriously.
Now, I, of course, have to ask you about the various alleged UFO evidence and the recent congressional hearings on UFOs or UAPs. Do you feel like this had an impact on, like, the average person's interest in or willingness to, you know, give credence to UFO reports or to give credence to the possibility of alien life? And how should we logically consider the current state of UFO, UAP evidence or lack thereof?
Yes. So that's the reason why about a third of the book is about UFOs and UAPs, because I really wanted people to understand how science sees them, how scientists see them. Because, of course, as you say, because of pop culture, right, UFOs have the alien invasion happened in the 50s and they won. Right. They live in our heads. In many ways, for me, the prevalence of UAPs and UFOs now is actually because of what's been happening with the science, right? Since the 1990s, every week there's a new story, Earth-like planet found orbiting other stars. The fact that scientists have been so clearly been willing to take the search for life seriously on alien worlds, I think helped in some way smooth the ground for this, you know, explosion of interest in UAPs. And the whole, I document both the history of, you know, UAP or of UFOs going back to 1947, the first sighting. And people really need to know that because that shapes a lot of UFO culture. Mm-hmm. To what's happening now with that 2017 New York Times article, right? That's what blew it, everything out of the water with those three videos, which have been, you know, cycle endlessly over and over again. And people sort of think there's lots of videos. There's really only those three. But the important thing is, I think that for people to understand where we're at, right, and where we're going. And that's what I try and give people in the book. So the first thing is that absolutely, for a scientist, there is no evidence, not even close, that would link anything about UFOs or UAPs to alien life, to something non-human, right? And you actually, and that's why I wanted people to, you know, if you actually look even what has happened since 2017, that conclusion holds. You know, scientists are brutal. We're really, really mean to each other, you know, about like trying to link a piece of data to a claim. Right. And we are brutal and nasty to each other because that is how we can ensure that we're correct. If we weren't brutal and nasty to each other, you and I wouldn't be using these amazing technologies. Right. You know, quantum mechanics, electronics, you know, electromagnetism, all the science that goes into the technology you and I are using right now was because scientists are so mean to each other. And the data for UFOs and UAPs just isn't even close to that. It's either blurry photographs, which haven't changed over 70 years, right? I mean, they're still blurry photographs. Come on. Or personal testimony. And personal testimony, it's not much science can do with that. So I think it's great that the pilots feel that they, you know, pilots have the freedom to report what they're seeing. Because, you know, they are seeing something. The question is, what are they seeing? So like Ryan Graves, you know, he's one of the pilots who's involved with this. I was on his podcast. He and I have had some really great conversations. So that's great. And I'm all for an open, transparent, you know, investigation by, like, they say the NASA panel or Project Galileo to investigate this, right? And let's go where the data leads us. But as of right now, that data does not lead us anywhere that would point to extraterrestrials. So, for example, at the NASA panel held a hearing, and you know they were talking about their results and the results of some of the other agencies. And you know, one of the things that was talked about there was, you know, of the 1,000 or 800 or so sightings, including those, you know, from the military that the government has and announced in that famous report in 2021, only 6% couldn't be explained, right? Only 6%, right? Which means that the other 94% had reasonable explanations. The sky is not full of unexplainable stuff, which, you know, the hype around UFOs and UAPs makes it seem like, oh my God. And then even that 6%, you know, some of those are unexplained because you can't even begin to make an explanation. Now, I will note, though, and I talk about this in the book, that some of the ones in the unexplained category are truly, when you hear the stories, you know, are truly freaky deaky, right? In the sense like a ghost story, it raises the hair on the back of your neck. Mm-hmm. But until you do the research, you know, those ones are probably, we'll see. We'll just see where those go. But the fact is, the vast, overwhelming majority are either explainable or don't have enough data to explain, with a tiny minority that are like, wow, okay, that's interesting. And then we're just going to have to do the but again, that's, so even with that category, that's not a place that you're, or that's not enough to be, make this jump to this enormous conclusion that, that aliens are visiting us, because, you know, again, you need this very solid data chain, not just personal testimony, not that somebody said, oh, the radar operator said it was moving at this speed. I need to see the instrument. I need to know how that instrument was built. I need to know just like I would with the James Webb Space Telescope.
So how well prepared are we culturally and or institutionally to either, you know, have that glimpse of some distant world where there's a strong possibility that what we're looking at is, you know, anything ranging from a techno signature that we can put stock in, or some sort of a megastructure, or even on the other end of the spectrum, like actual first contact. Like, how prepared are we for those possibilities?
I believe that it will be the most profound discovery in human history. It will reshape our understanding. And again, I don't care even if we detect a planet and, you know, through its study find that it's got a biosphere. That is equally, it doesn't have to be a civilization, right? And the reason for that is life is so bizarre compared to every other physical system. So I'm involved. I'm part of a project. I'm actually the PI on this other study where we're also just looking at the physics of life. We're trying to answer, why is life so different from every other physical system, right? So for example, you know, black holes are weird. Black holes are crazy, right? But a black hole will never invent a giant rabbit that can punch you in the face, which is a kangaroo, right? Only evolution does that. Life is the only physical system which invents, which creates, which innovates. And right now, as far as we know, we're the only example of life in the entire universe. Like, you know, are we a one-off? Are we an accident? Are we a mistake? Or is life with all of its creative capacity common? Because even if it's just life, even if it's just microbes, it means that we're part of a community, a cosmic community of life. And because of life's innovative capacities, who knows, you know, if life is common, who knows where it's gone? I don't need to find an alien civilization. I just need to find a microbe, because then I know that evolution is something that the universe does more than just here. And evolution is unbounded. Evolution can do anything. So I don't think we would have riots in the street, you know, but I don't think that's going to be necessary. But I do think, you know, if people want an example, the Copernican Revolution, right? You know, in 1400, you went to bed and you were like, oh, the sun's going to rise tomorrow because the earth is the center of the universe and the sun goes around the earth. And then 200 years later, you went to bed and you're like, oh, the sun doesn't come up. The horizon goes down because the earth is spinning as it goes around the sun. And that was just an astronomical discovery. And yet the Copernican Revolution figures in the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Protestant Reformation. It was, you know, it was a game changer. It actually rewired how all of humanity understood itself and what was possible. So, you know, these astronomical discoveries don't just sit out there in some egghead's brain, you know, they matter and they always have mattered. So finding life in the universe, one way or the other, would change everything. Finding a civilization would, that now that outright, that takes us even further. And I think the most important thing there is, you know, we are so horrible to each other. We're such a messed up species, and though we're capable of so much. And it's not clear whether or not through nuclear war or climate change or AI, whether we're going to still be around in 100 years or 500 years. Finding a civilization, as I discuss in the book, because we did research on this, would mean finding a civilization means finding an older civilization. That's what the probability tells you. Anything you find will be older. And that means somebody made it, right? It would be like an existence proof that long-lived civilizations are possible. And we don't have to have contact with them. We don't have to talk to them. Just knowing they were there would be proof that, yeah, you know what? It's possible to get through all of that evolutionary baggage and you know, make it last for a long time.
That's a wonderful way of looking at it. I don't think I'd you know, quite thought about that spin on it before. Now, another thing that you talk about in the book I wanted to ask you about here is getting beyond sort of the mirror image idea of what alien life consists of, you know, because you know, as everyone always discusses, like life on Earth and our model of intelligent life is the only model we have when considering what might be out there. But what else is possible?
Yeah, the most fun parts of the book for me were the last, you know, third or so, where I started asking, you know, using what we understand with the science we have, what might aliens look like and what might they be like? So the first part of that is understanding how evolution works, right? So we know the laws of physics and chemistry are universal. They're going to occur anywhere. And we also, the Darwinian evolution is really a logic. It's a logic that anything we want to call alive probably has to follow. So that means you can use those as kind of guide rails. You know, remember when you went bowling when you were a little kid and they had those bumper rails that kept your ball? That's what science is, right? Science is constrained imagination. You want to use your imagination, but you also don't want to just write science fiction stories. So you can use those three principles, physics, chemistry, and Darwinian evolution. And the cool thing about that is you see in evolution, there are two forces. There's convergence. Physics and chemistry is going to give life problems. How do you move around? How do you find food? You know, are you in a water world? Are you in a world that has a surface and then an atmosphere? evolution will probably find the same kinds of solutions to those problems. Like, for example, wings, right? If you have an atmosphere, then, you know, passing air over a curved surface, great way to get around, right? Wings. But it doesn't mean the wings will look anything like what has happened here. Could be like some kind of weird bony frame with like mucus, a gooey mucus, you know, in between them. That was just something I had to think of some ideas. But evolution also works by accidents, like a trillion accidents. So this battle between accidents and sort of the you know, physics and chemistry means that, you know, legs, you should expect to find legs being, you know, evolved in lots of places, but don't expect them to look anything like what we have here. And in fact, accidents are so important that Stephen Jay Gould, the great evolutionary biologist, said that if you rewind the tape of life on Earth and allowed it to start over again, you wouldn't have any species of the kind that we have today. Everything would be different. And this leads to a startling conclusion, which is that in spite of Star Trek and in spite of Star Wars, we are the only humans in the entire universe. We are the only humanoids in the entire universe. So we should not expect to find, you know, little grays, little green men. You know, the idea of a head on top of shoulders with two arms and two legs, you know, maybe with an antenna on the forehead. You know, I talk about the whole idea of prosthetic foreheads in the prevalence of prosthetic foreheads in sci-fi. That's just not going to happen. You know, the odds are, you know, it's pretty remote. So when we think about life in the universe, we should expect to be surprised, and we might also expect to be grossed out by what we find. So that's the first point. And then we can talk about alien ethics and alien minds. There's always this idea that, oh, you know, we're going to be able to figure out a way to communicate because they'll, you know, like Carl Sagan thought, oh, we'll teach them our math and then we'll translate our math to their math. And that will be the beginning, you know, and then very soon after, you know, figuring out that pi, you know, is involved with circles, we'll be sharing knock-knock jokes and cures for cancer. But that may not be possible at all. And one of my favorite science fiction movies is Arrival, right? With that great, you know, aliens arrive, they send in a Carl Sagan kind of character and a linguist. And the Carl Sagan character with his, you know, using math to communicate fails spectacularly. And it's the linguist who understands that language is not about mathematics. It's about the experience of being in a body and living, and she makes contact to find out that they actually have a very different kind of physics even. They live or experience of physics. They live past, present, and future at the same time. So I think, you know, the beautiful part about this study, the scientific study, is how we can use science to systematically explore or imagine the unimaginable, right? What we have to do now is get beyond the terrestrial and imagine life as we don't know it. And there's a bunch of different projects by different people. You know, we're trying to do this in our own project, but to really break past the boundaries of Earth life. And that's really exciting because, you know, it's great to go places where, you know, you want to be surprised. The universe is much more imaginative than we are.
Yeah. And of course, I can't help but think of various sci-fi visions we've had that try and get into this, like the differences in what a potential extraterrestrial civilization could want compared to us. And I guess like this more basic sort of Twilight Zone era version of this is like, well, we want to explore and they want to eat us, right? But, you know,
it's a cookbook.
Yeah, it's a cookbook.
Best episode ever.
it's still a wonderful episode. But then you have all these other, you know, visions. I instantly think of like Ian M. Banks's culture novels where he gets into the idea of like very advanced civilizations just ending up with fundamentally different goals and ambitions to the point where they just like sort of blink out of existence and so forth. And I feel like those kind of examples kind of help us expand our horizon on imagining what aliens could want. And then also, of course, just sort of brings us to a limit and realize, oh, there are all these other things we can't even imagine.
Right, right. And then, but that's what's cool is we have to then sort of try to imagine them. We have to figure out how to work our way. Like, because so then what that means is, and this was the fun part of exploring this in the book, and people hopefully, you know, can take this journey along with us, is you have to sort of, the first thing you do is figure out, okay, where am I blinded? Right. So the first job is to say, what are the constraints that I've been operating? Where are my biases? What have I been blinding myself to? Identify those. And then you can see, like, oh, I got to go around those, you know, and begin to work on that. So, you know, the science fiction writers, I've always wanted to have a meeting between scientists and science fiction writers because I, you know, I read a lot of science fiction. And I find often a lot of my best ideas that I want to pursue in research come from, you know, science fiction writers as storytellers have a kind of imaginative capacity that I think we lack in science because of these biases that we've put on for ourselves. And so, but, and they're systematically doing it, right? In the sense that they have to write a story that has, mm-hmm. you know, challenges and obstacles, et cetera. So I think that could be really fruitful. And that's part of this frontier that we're on. We're going to look for life. And as we look for life, we have to look for things that are not just replicas of life here on Earth.
Adam, thanks for coming on the show. This has been a treat. This is a great way to start my my Wednesday morning here, November 1st. The book, The Little Book of Aliens, is available in all formats. I think it's going to be a great stocking stuffer, if you will, for anybody on the spectrum of interest in or skepticism about or enthusiasm for alien life.
Thanks, Rob. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks once more to Adam Frank for coming on the show. Again, the book is The Little Book of Aliens, available now in all formats. You can read more about his work at adamfrankscience.com, and his Facebook author's page is Adam Frank Author. Thanks, as always, to the excellent J.J. Posway for producing the show. A reminder that we are a science podcast here at Stuff to Blow Your Mind with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact episode. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. And yes, we have been meaning to discuss Forbidden Planet and maybe This Island Earth for some time. So I don't know, maybe this conversation will encourage us to go ahead and view one of those selections. As always, you can follow us wherever you follow your various shows online. We're on all of our social media accounts are now reactivated. I recommend you check them out. We are STBYM Podcast on Instagram, so follow us there if you're not already following us. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us directly at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.